Vous écoutez Scepticisme Scientifique, le balado de la science et de la raison, un podcast consacré à l'étude scientifique du paranormal, à la pensée critique et à la philosophie.
Dr. Abrasar, the psychosocial model of UFOs. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much for having me. So, yeah, my native language is French, so sorry for my pronunciation if sometimes I slipped. I did my PhD in psychology at the UC Louvain, so in Belgium, in the French-speaking area of Belgium, on the topic of ufology, which is quite rare. We can talk about that, of course, but the experience of studying ufology in an academic setting is fascinating in itself. I did that because of my interest on the topic, and I didn't have any money to study, so I did it working on the side to finance my PhD. So that's also one of the first things. You can study that subject, but you don't have any grant to do it. You have to finance the study of by yourself. And maybe, probably you know, but you know him in my committee. There was Renaud Evrard, who is someone invested in the Parapsychological Association. I think he's been the president at some point. He was in my jury, and I work with him quite a bit, even if his topic is a lot more parapsychology and me ufology. So I got interested in the ufology because of the Belgian UFO wave. So I think if I'm here tonight, it's to talk about what's going on our side of the channel in Belgium and France. Unfortunately, there's not so much communication between ufologists here and on your side of the channel. Especially, I think it's a lot our fault, because at least in France, the English level is not that high, so they have trouble reading or speaking English. So that's why they often don't know what's going on in the English speaking world. I'm kind of the exception on that front. But so I'm going to try to talk about what's going on in Belgium and France. So, of course, the Belgian UFO wave, I'm sure you heard about it in 89. And if we push a little bit, we can say it finished around 92. It was a big event. I was around 14 years old at the time. I didn't see anything myself, but I was quite intrigued by how the news on TV and the journals were covering, and also that group, ufological group called SUBEPS, who studied that wave. And what I felt was a lack of critical thinking on the part of the journalist on that front. I'll talk about it more, but of course that started my interest, and then because of that I chose to study that topic when I went into psychology. And around 2004, I was in a laboratory of psychology of religion. So usually in psychology of religion, you study the psychological traits that influence what people believe, if they are atheist or Christian, or you can do studies like that with questionnaires, for example. And I did some research in that, but I was studying the psychology of paranormal belief. I'm sure you're familiar probably with the work of Irwin on that topic. There's been quite a bit of study on the psychology of paranormal belief, why people believe in the paranormal. which is interesting in itself, because if you want to, yeah, if you want to study, at least in my university, that kind of topic, well, the angle you're supposed to adopt is always, why do people believe in it? And you cannot really talk about the phenomena in itself, or what I call the ontological debate. They are not in, the teachers are always, please avoid the ontological debate. Don't talk about is it true or not. Just study if why what personality traits influence what they believe. And after that, I joined the group Comité Nord-Est des groupes ufologiques. I will talk quite a bit about their work. So it's a group. It's one of the last ufological group that still exists, that meets physically and not only on the internet. And every few months they meet and they study UFO cases in the northeast of France. And they've produced quite a bit of work over the years. And I've been a member for something like 2 decades. I'm not anymore, but I've been a member for a long time. So I will talk about what kind of, CJ mentioned it, like the SARS operation. One of the big study they did. Currently, I'm a member of the Comité Belge pour l'analyse critique des parasciences, which is, or Comité Para, it's easier to say, which is the, as I said before, the oldest group, which is funny but for me. But yeah, it predates the PSYCOP, and actually Paul Kurtz at the PSYCOP took the idea from the Belgian group originally. The Belgian group was founded in 1947, and in the 50s, Paul Kurtz heard about it. And actually, at the beginning, the names were the same. The French name was exactly, if I translated in English, the Committee for Skeptical Investigation of the Paranormal. So exactly like the PSYCOP, like Paul Kurtz just used the same name in English. And that group, has been around for a while. It's been... Yeah, it was very active in the at the end of the war, because there were lots of psychics and medium who claimed they could find people on the battlefield. So that's why the group appeared at the time. And it's also been sleeping a lot, and the group didn't do anything, just continued to exist, but didn't do anything much. But recently I've been part of a group of people trying to make that group alive again, alive and kicking, I mean. And part of that was to create a scientific journal called Skepticism Scientifique. So actually the idea came a little bit because of the ASAP journal, Anomaly. I was inspired by that and I said, we need to have something like that. So we created that journal, and we are on the second year of publications now. For the moment, we only have online articles and not paper ones, but we're hoping to have paper ones at some point. So we already have some interesting articles about the Gévaudan beast, you know, that the monster from France, and other subject like that. And also I wrote a children book about the UFO phenomena from a skeptical point of view. That's the cover. And you can see it's called Zététicien en Herbe, so it comes zététic. So CJ mentioned that before the start, but zététic from Marcello Truzzi, you know, in France, the word zététic is quite used. It's still very popular. I don't know how much zététic is still known in America, but in France, it's still used quite a bit. So the name of it's a series of books that I wrote. So that one is on the UFO. So the name of the series is Budding Zetheticians. So I will use drawings from that book to illustrate my slides. So the psychosocial UFO hypothesis. There's a Wikipedia page. So of course it's an alternative to the extraterrestrial hypothesis, and it was very much popular in the United Kingdom with David Clark, Hilary Evans in Magonia magazine, and I'm sure you know a lot more than me about that. But it has also been popular in France since the publication in 1977 of a book written by Michel Monry, Et si les ovnis n'existaient pas. So those are the books that kickstarted the topic in the French-speaking world. So the big difference with before was before the critics of ufology were outsiders, but then Michel Monry was the president of a ufological organization. He had done a big operation of watching the skies and had been very disappointed by the results, especially the photographs, seeing that people took pictures of airplanes and so on and reported them as UFO. And he wrote the first book on the left, What If UFOs Didn't Exist? And then a few years later, he wrote the book on the right, Le Naufrage des Extraterrestres, which is even stronger title. It should be translated as something like UFOs Crashing Down. And Michel Monry didn't have, he was not an academic. So, I mean, he had, from a skeptical point of view, lots of good intuitions, but the vocabulary he used or the way he tried to explain were very, like, not academic. So after that, several university people tried to express his ideals, but in a more academic way. And I'm probably in that tradition in a way. So, of course, people use psychosocial hypothesis. I'm always like, why hypothesis? I think it's hypothesis just because extraterrestrial hypothesis. But for me, it's not really a hypothesis because we know that lots of UFO sightings can be explained by prosaic objects. So that's why I use psychosocial model instead of psychosocial hypothesis, because I don't think it's a hypothesis. I think it's a way to look at the phenomena. I think it's the way to think about it, but I don't think it's a hypothesis. So it's me. We've been discussing in France a lot about what would be the best name for that approach, but nobody is happy with even psychosocial hypothesis or model. So I use psychosocial model, but even though it's not perfect. And in that vein, Claude Mauger, another French writer, proposed another word. He proposed to call it, instead of psychosocial model, because the issue was, if you say psychosocial, it gives the impression that everything is psychological, when, of course, we think that the UFOs have most of the time, a stimuli in the sky. So there is something tangible in the sky, just the people make mistakes. So psychosocial gives the impression that everything is in their head, which it's not. So he wanted to try another word. So he tried reductionist composite theory. So reductionist because you reduce the phenomena. You try to find something prosaic or mundane to explain what the person has seen. And composite because for him it was very important to stress the fact that there was not one explanation for every sighting, to avoid the mistakes of the past of people trying to say everything is swamp gas, for example, or everything. You can explain all the cases with one explanation. He wanted to insist on the fact that actually there are many different stimuli that can generate a UFO sighting. So my way of explaining the fact that the psychosocial model is a way to look at the phenomena is a haystack. I'm always like, okay, all the UFO sightings are a big haystack. And some people think that in the haystack, there's a needle to be found. Well, myself, I'm skeptical. I think there's probably no needle, but maybe there is, maybe I'm wrong. But in a way, what interests me is the haystack. Like, you can study the haystack or you can try to find the needle, and it's the two different approaches. Classical ufology is looking for the needle. Me, I'm looking at the haystack and I'm trying to understand how it works. That's why I wrote articles about hallucinations in ufology or why people make hoax. I'm interested by the haystack, not by the quest for the needle. Because I think the haystack is absolutely fascinating in itself. The fact that so many people see mundane objects and think they are from outer space is absolutely fascinating. So that's the haystack. Those are the data. I took them yesterday, preparing this speech, from the GEIPAN. So the GEIPAN is the French, an official French organization for the study of PAN. So PAN is UAP in French. So GEIPAN is the study of UAP. It's part of CNES, so the National Center for Space Exploration. So it's a section of the equivalence of the NASA for the French, and they have that section called GEIPAN for studying UFO. So let's be clear, it's very, very, very small. To my knowledge, it's actually one person and one secretary. But the way they decided to work is to ask for help from people like from my ufological organization. So we collaborate with them, and they will say, we have a case, can you go investigate? And I don't do that myself, so I cannot be specific because I'm not French, so I'm Belgian. But most of my friends, they are part of that system. So the person in the office at the CNES don't go investigate usually. He just call for some of people from the organization to help for free. So in the database of the GEIPAN right now, they have 3,037 cases. And you can see they have 24 cases that are perfectly, so 24% are perfectly identified. 39% are probably identified. 32% are non-identified because of lack of data. And it leaves 3% of cases that are not unidentified after investigation with sufficient data. So those who are interested in the needle, they're interested in the 3% left on, if that's the 3% that they're interested in. I'm more interested in everything else in the haystack. So the way we think about it is, that's the vocabulary we use in France. We say there are simple mistakes, complex mistakes, and then hallucination, false memory, and hoaxes. But the distinction is, the most important one is between simple mistakes and complex mistakes. Simple mistakes is the most common cases when people see something in the sky, they fail to recognize what it is, but then when they are asked to describe what they saw, they are fairly accurate. They give a very good description of what they saw, and usually it helps a lot the investigators find the stimuli. So that's the most of the cases. But then there are complex mistakes, and complex mistakes are the most fascinating one for a psychologist. It's the one where there will be a distortion of what was seen. So there was something real in the sky, but then the subject will transform the description of what he saw. And that transformation will occur because of the culture pressure. All the images we have in our head about science fiction and ufology. Then after that, hallucinations. I wrote an article about that topic because I was like, it's strange for, it's something that most people, it's like a taboo subject in ufology, like it never happens, but would be weird if it was really the case, given the number of people having hallucinations for real in the population. And actually, I had a case years ago with a subject who would see a ball of light in his room, floating every other night, and talking to him in his head. So that was a good example. I think I would say schizophrenia, but it's, I mean, the fact that those cases, I mean, I think those cases should be also documented. I mean, it, if you're interested in the haystack. And then false memories, we know about Roswell or other, also abduction phenomena, it's something important. And hoaxes. For hoaxes, I like the concept of ostension. Ostension is a concept in folkloristic about manifesting a folklore in real life. And classic example of ostensions are in the literature, they're always the same given, but like a group of teenagers going into a cemetery at night to scare themselves, or going to a haunted house to scare themselves and trying the Ouija board. Those are ostensions of in folkloristic, like giving life to a folklore. And I think it's very interesting to think about hoaxes as kind of ostension. The people, there's that UFO folklore, mythology, whatever the word you want to use. And some people will make it come alive through making hoaxes. So the complete mistakes, I think the way I like to think about it is there are three steps in transforming an observation. The first one is during the sighting. There can be illusion happening. Yeah, the classic one, I had the three lanterns, Thai lantern, lots of cases like that for the moment, a three Thai lantern. And then when you look in the sky, they look, you see the three points, and then it becomes a spaceship with three points, because when you have three points, you tend to fill in the blank, and classic illusion. And yeah, the second drawing we had was about the moon. We'll arrive to the moon topic later, but of course the moon, lots of sightings of mistake with the moon when people drive the car because of the autocinetic illusion. When you're in the car, you see the moon chasing you, and then it helps for the sighting, of course. And then the second time it can happen is when you remember, when you start remembering what happened. And that's the confabulation step. Sorry. And then that means each time you remember a memory, you start changing it. And of course, the more times passes, the more the memories will change. And in sociology, it's always the same. Like, you know, I got a fish that big, and then the next week that big, and then the fish gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then when you have the testimony, then there's the suggestibility, because you can be influenced by the way you are asked questions. It's the all the difficult problem of leading questions. If you ask questions that pinpoint toward an answer, it will influence the witness, and it will change his actual memory. So that's something that really clearly happened in the Belgian UFO wave. So the main actor in the suburbs was a physicist called August Mason. And August Mason was from the German-speaking part of Belgium, from Eupen, which is a really small community in Belgium. And the first two witnesses, the cops that kickstarted the Belgian wave, they were from that same area. So he was the one who went to ask question, and he had different aspects that could put pressure on them to change what they think they saw. First off, he was a university teacher, and secondly, he spoke their language, so German, but not only their language, but their dialectal language from that area. So he was like a neighbor for them. At the time, he wasn't living there anymore, but he was like someone from the area. So for them, it was really, it must have been very impressive. And after they published transcript of their interview, so we know the testimony changed, because we can go back in time, and before August Mason interviewed them and after them, details were clearly added in what they saw. It was from so the second phase of the observation. So for that observation, they follow something very, very, very bright according to them, but nobody else notices anything, even though they're near a highway and so on. But it's super bright. Then, according to them, then they lose that object from sight, and then they find it again, and it's above a dam. And we think actually one of the issue was it's actually two different objects they saw. They linked two things together that were not the same object. The first one, that's the first part with the very bright object. I mean, we doubt it was very bright because, as I said, they were in a very populated area with lots of car passing, according to them, but nobody saw anything, even though they said it was as bright as a football stadium. Hypothesis we have is probably maybe an helicopter. But for the second part of the sighting, it's pretty clear it was Venus they saw. The location, it was in the sky, perfect for Venus. And when they gave the first description of that phase of the sighting, they're clearly describing Venus. But after they had the interview with August Smith, and suddenly lots of details were added, and suddenly there were like short lines getting out of the objects and stuff like that. And yeah, they published a transcript, and you can really see how some part of the dialogue, and you can see how August Mason asked questions that influenced the witness very clearly. So that's the whole problem of leading questions. Also, how to avoid that when you do an investigation, well, we can talk about it. It is no easy solution to that. So we mentioned that before, but of course, in our point of view, there's a clear influence, a retraction influence between culture and what people see. Because when there's something in the sky they cannot recognize, especially during the complex mistakes, the idea they have in their head of what a UFO is supposed to look like will influence their perception. And of course, what science fiction and ufology has told us to see change over time, and so it's changed. But what's really in the skies, of course, play also an important role. Lots of sphere in the sky, lots of points, lots of triangles. So it's always there's the two sides, what's really in the sky and what cultures makes people think they should see in the sky. So now that the big study they did at CNEGU, that ufological group in the northeast of France, is called the SARS operation. So they had at the time, I don't know, I think it was 20 years ago, something like that. I wasn't there at the time. So it's still continuing, but I helped publish the article in Anomaly, but it started a while ago. They were talking and they were like, so it was a group of people who were classical alien ufologists at some point, then started move toward more psychosocial model. So at the time they were like, one of them said, is it possible for some people to confuse the moon with a UFO? And the other were like, no, it's not possible. And everybody knows what the moon looks like. How could you confuse the moon with a UFO? It's not possible. So they came up with an idea to test that hypothesis, which is very interesting because we know it's very difficult to really test and do empirical experiments on those questions. But so they found a very interesting idea based on the SAROS. So the SAROS in astronomy is a period that brings back the moon exactly 18 years in the same position in the sky. So that means it's not the same season, but the moon is at the right spot in the sky. So it's not perfect, but to have the moon come back at the same spot and have the same period of the year, that would ask a much longer cycle. So 18 years is already very long. But then what they decided to do is to go back into their case database of cases and find all the cases they thought it could have been a moon, a mistake with the moon, And then they went back and checked either with the, at the beginning they systematically did with the witness, and then after that without the witness sometimes, but to see if it matched. So it's not perfect, because in 18 years, of course, in, even if the season can be different, there can be clouds that night. They can have built a building and then that wasn't there before. So you don't have the line of sight to see the moon anymore. But it still worked well enough to realize, to make people see, and they're like, oh yeah, that's actually exactly what I saw that day. Especially lots of cases, as I mentioned before, of people driving a car and they have the impression that the UFO is following them in their car, chasing them. And then if you, in that case, the CNEGU team, they went in the car with the witness and they would drive the same way, and the moon would show up exactly at the same position of the UFO in their cases. So another case that was studied a lot by published, there was an interesting publication by the CNEGU, was about the Kelly Hopkinsville encounter. So I'm sure you know Kelly Hopkinsville, probably even the explanation, but it came from us actually. So that's a very famous case in 1955 of a family of farmer with there's a sighting of saying something flying in the sky. Well, we don't know it was a meteorite. But then after that, when the farmer comes back, the Sutton, he comes back to the house, and then there are two aliens attacking or threatening the farm, and there's some, it's a very dramatic story, some gunfire shot and so on. And Renaud Leclerc, one of the member of organization, he did a very thorough study showing that every details in the account of the case can be explained with a mistake with a great owl, American great owl. The way the alien behave, like he seems to be floating, and the way they go on the roof and start scratching on the roof, and every single little detail can be traced back to that. So that's a good example of a very impressive mistake. Actually, in this case, it would be a simple mistake, because they gave a very good description of what they saw. We all the details that we had, we could find what they saw for real. But then often it generates what I call an argument from incredulity, even among skeptics who are not interested in the topic like I am. They would say, it's me, I call that the argument from incredulity. It's just, I cannot believe that someone would make such a mistake. That's the argument, right? I cannot believe it. It's just not possible. Like people cannot confuse the moon with UFOs, or a farmer cannot confuse a great American great hall with an alien. I mentioned that because I think it's kind of an appeal to emotion. I'm like, yeah, if you don't have a better explanation than the one we propose, but you cannot believe it, but what do you want me to say? But it's often really the gut reaction that people have. But I think the only real rational way would be, let's find another explanation, a better one. Like for the Kelly Hopkinsville, if people can find a better explanation than the one we found, which I don't think, I think we got the right one. But, I mean, but just it's funny, even among skeptics, which is really interesting. Brian Dunning, I think, did an episode about the Kelly Hopkinsville, mentioning that explanation from Renaud Leclerc from our organization. Even the skeptics were like, no, I cannot believe it's not possible that something like that people would do. And I think me as a psychologist, I'm like, no, actually studying the UFO phenomena, you discover that actually people do that kind of mistake, which is the real fascinating fact. There was also a case, unfortunately was not well documented, during the French wave in 1955. It was reported by a journalist, so maybe it's not reliable, but in that case, during that wave, there was lots of of sightings of encountered of the third kind, and that person saw a UFO landing on the road near his house and went with a gun and tried to shoot at the alien. And according to the journalist, it was one of his neighbors trying to change his battery. So, of course, it's a journalist, so maybe that story is not reliable. But I mean, we see that some case. Well, one of the example, anyway, the best way to explain that it's really possible. It's always like, you know, hunters every summer, they make mistake like that. Every year in France or Belgium, you have stories of hunters. They go in the journal. He was in the forest and he shot someone jogging in the forest wearing very bright colored clothes. And when you ask him, they say, I thought he was a deer. And you're like, how can you confuse a deer with someone jogging with bright clothes? And usually the journalist will make comments about hunters liking alcohol, which is exactly the kind of comments journalists will make about UFO sightings. I think it's very telling. But if you think about all those hunter anecdotes of people shooting at things they think it's an animal when it's a human being and they should have seen it clearly, but actually they saw something. It's because, once more, and the process is, they're in a difficult environment. But for UFO, it's at night, but for hunters, it's the forest, but probably not so maybe well lit. And they expect to see something. For UFO, it's people expect to see what they saw in science fiction. But for the hunter, he expects to see a deer. And then you don't see really with your eyes, you see with your brain. And in very confusing information, your brain reconstructs the image incorrectly, and he sees a deer when there's actually someone for a brief lapse of time, but it's enough for him to shoot at the person. So what about the expert witness, pilot, cops, and so on? But for me, I'm always like, experts are people that make mistakes less than non-experts. So it's not a very good argument, especially for real. Nobody can be an expert in recognizing alien spaceship because we don't know what an alien spaceship would look like. And I always have a Japanese saying for that. So it's the Japanese saying is, even monkeys fall from trees sometimes. So even an expert in climbing falls sometimes. So I don't really buy the expert, or those are experts, so like pilots or cops. For the Belgian UFO wave, of course, the fact that they were cops, the two first witness, was a very, very important starting point to the wave. The first night of the wave, the suburbs will say the first night of the wave, there were lots of witness, independent witness. But the thing is, they were not truly independent, because what happened the first night of the wave, there were the two cops, and the two cops, they appeared in the newspaper 2 days later, if my memory is correct, and they said, here's what we saw. And then after that, people started calling the, so in those articles, they said, if you have any information, please call the suburbs or that ufological group. And then after that, people started to call the suburbs, and they said, that day I saw something. Sometimes they even said before that day, but that's a few cases. But what happened is, it's not independent anymore, because they made a big case of those being independent, but they're not independent, because actually they read the description of the UFO in the journal, and then only after that they called the suburbs and said, that's what I saw. So the journal already influence what they, who knows if they would have even testified, I think they wouldn't have testified, the Joe, we'll see that later. But so the fact that they were cops in the media played a very important role, because they seemed like legitimate witness, like and that we should believe. And I'm not saying I don't believe what they said, I think they're sincere, of course, wrong but sincere. But the fact that, which is strange as an argument from authority, I mean, like, why cops? I mean, at best we know they didn't do a prank, and we know that they didn't drink alcohol, but why cops would be better witnesses than anybody else, I don't know. That's another important book in the that was written a few years back. So before, so that there was the JPAN, the organization that studied UFO for the French government, has existed for a long time, since 1977. And around the 90s, the director, the one person in charge of that section, was named Jean-Jacques Velasco, and he was really pushing the extraterrestrial hypothesis in the media. He was saying we have cases that prove the extraterrestrial hypothesis on TV regularly. And the CNES, so the equivalent, the French equivalent of NASA, was quite embarrassed actually, because they what to do with that, with that person saying we have the proof that aliens are here. And so our group of investigators, we tried to contact and say, can we access the your files, your database, to check. You say you have cases that prove for sure the extraterrestrial hypothesis, so can we have access to them, and can we check them? And at first he said no. Then we put pressure through university to have access to those files, and at the end we did.
That they had at the start.
I couldn't understand if it was a question or not. sorry. We could access, and then we checked all the cases that he said were bulletproof, if you want. And in that book, we go through them and show that actually they're not so bulletproof as he thinks they are. So that book is, if you want to have, it's just a collection of what was considered before that the strongest French case until 2007. And the team of writers explained for each case why the investigation is not conclusive, as the director said at the time. Actually, now there's a new director, there has been several new directors since then, and they do a much better work communicating, and work in general they do a much better one. So I'm quite happy with that organization right now. So for me, what would be a proof of alien visitation? But I always like to compare to the Loch Ness monster, because we have the same kind of proof. We have witnesses, we have sonar for the Loch Ness, but we have radar for UFO. We have pictures, blurry pictures, or not so blurry, but probably hoax pictures. So we are just in the same situation, just the Loch is a lot smaller. So most people are convinced, actually the consensus in zoology is that there are no Loch Ness monster, right? So just because the space is really limited, so that's an advantage. Of course, there are still some people who would say we should have to drain the lake to be sure, but the problem with UFO is that it's so vast. I mean, it's anywhere on around the Earth. They appear suddenly. That's the problem. So for me, it's very similar, but the Loch Ness is a very good small space for that. And for zoologists, what would be a proof? But would be a specimen of the Loch Ness monster, or a sample. So for alien, it would be a sample or aliens technology. So with all I said before, with about the weaknesses of alien of witness testimony, the fact that human testimony is not reliable, I think that just testimonies are not enough to prove the extraterrestrial hypothesis. We need way more than that. One argument I like is the argument for silence. The argument from silence is in history. It means you conclude something from the lack of evidence. So you lack proof of something happened in history. So if you say they should, I think there was a battle in that year, but you cannot find any tangible proof of that battle, then you make an argument from silence. There's not enough proof. So the best bet is that there was no battle that year. And I think for skeptics like me, we do an argument from silence. In 7 decades of ufology, we haven't found any tangible proof of alien visitation. So the best bet is there's no alien visiting Earth until proven contrary. But yeah, that's not mine, but it shows. I'm not a big fan of the extraordinary evidence stuff. I think we just need simple proof for the, we just don't have proof of alien visitation, but it shows, yeah, what we have is photos in the LIS, you know, in low information zone. We have videos and anecdotes and stuff that are unconvincing. And then on the other hand, we know, we have lots of stuff we know are proven by sociology and psychology. So to change that, once more, we should have to change that position, to change that consensus, we would need something way more tangible than what we have now. Of course, one of the problems is the science based on anomaly hunting. I'm sure you're all aware of that. I mean, anomaly hunting, it's intrinsically a problematical methodology. I always say it's like we imagine the cops studying, investigating murders, and then there are 3% of murders the cops don't find the culprit, and we say, well, then it's alien. It's not a good methodology. So I think anomaly hunting is always epistemologically problematic. That's why parapsychology, for example, has an advantage because they can do laboratory studies, which ufologists can't do. But just simple anomaly hunting is always tricky to good science. So in epistemology, we'll also talk about ad hoc hypothesis. So ad hoc hypothesis is hypothesis you add to your theory to explain the lack an issue in your data. So of course, in ufology, the issue is the lack of tangible proof. So there are two main ad hoc hypotheses. Try to protect the core idea of extraterrestrial visitation. The first ad hoc is the hypothesis is that there is a global cover-up. Then that explains why we don't have tangible proof. And the other one is aliens are not so... I've been talking my whole talk about aliens, like really physical, biological alien in a tangible spaceship. But then you can start saying, well, they're more like angels or fairies. And in France, one of the most popular idea on that side is called mimetism, is that it's something that often is opposed to skeptics in France. I have no idea in England, in Great Britain, but it's the idea that UFO would mimic airplanes or helicopters and so on. So they would look like, they would shape-shift into airplanes. So some people say, I saw a UFO and suddenly it moved toward me and it started to look like an airplane. And then it wasn't a mistake. Like that witness doesn't conclude, well, I just saw an airplane from all along. He would say the UFO actually transformed into an airplane because he didn't want to be detected. So that's really popular in France at the moment on that other side of the ad hoc hypothesis. So for me, for the anecdote, I interviewed Patrick Rochin, the person who took the picture, or the very, very famous picture of the Petit Rochin, who hoaxed the picture, when he revealed that hoax. Of course, it's very rarely mentioned, but when the picture came out, Pierre Maguin, a physicist in Belgium, wrote an article in a peer-reviewed journal in physics stating that he thought that the picture was very dubious, but he wasn't a member of the SOBEPS, obviously, and that article was not very mentioned at the time in the press or so on. But very early on, some people were very skeptical of that picture. But then, Patrick Maréchal, sorry, revealed he took that picture using some very basic special effect. I don't know how to express in English, but it's kind of a plank with holes, and then he put small lights, small light bulbs behind each holes, and then he took the picture like that. And he had some other shots he took at the time with other variation of the composition of the frame. He took the best one and sent him. Right? There's a whole complex story about that, how it reached Patrick Maréchal. He wanted just to do a prank to his colleague at the factory because he used to work in a factory. And then a journalist heard about that and asked him to use that picture. And then some money was involved, and the rest is history. But so for me, the Belgian UFO wave, my current conclusion, the suburbs for me clearly failed to prove that something, that there was an Indian invasion, that there was a Independence Day in Belgium in 1892. They will often say, August Mason, the lead scientist, the physicist that interviewed the first witness, he was very convinced that it was extraterrestrial in origin. The other, they tend to say, we just cannot explain what happened. I'm always joking about that because I went to an event they organized, and they were really happy to say they cannot explain what happened. And I'm like, usually scientists are not happy to not be able to explain something. Usually the job of scientists is to explain things and not to be, oh yes, we failed to explain completely something. It's amazing. But I don't know, it's strange. Of course, the suburbs had many issues. It was a very small group of person, four or five, but they had credentials. Two of them were physicists working at university. So the journalists were very trusting toward them. And they published everything in their newsletter, and in one volume they auto-published, probably you know that cover, called The Belgian UFO Wave 1, and they did a second tome called The Belgian UFO Wave 2. So they completely bypassed the scientific peer review process. They never tried to publish an article in a peer review process, even though August Mason, the lead scientist, said he worked on that picture, and then he said, I can explain the propulsion of the UFO based on magneto hydrodynamics. Even that he didn't publish in a peer review journal. He was quite heartbroken he couldn't believe when the Patrick Maréchal revealed he was a hoax. His position was like, Patrick Maréchal is lying, it's obviously a real picture, but because he built all his career on that picture. But August Mason, to give you a fair, he was convinced that Chupacabra was real, then alien abduction was real, and he wrote also a paper about the telepathy of gray based on the shape of their eyes. So that gives you his scientific orientation right there. None of them were in peer-reviewed journal, all of them were in his the suburbs fanzine, if you want. So for me, the suburbs often claims they did something amazing during that time, but for me, they should have published. If they did half what they claim they do, they should have published in Nature and get the Nobel Prize, but they didn't. It's not as airtight as they claimed it's been. All the other pictures were not impressive at all. That was the only picture, so that's why it's always the one we see. That's the one that was on the cover of their book. There was also some radar detection from, but they all can be explainable by artifact. The most famous one was by two FCS chasing a UFO, but the thing is, the two FCS, they chased the UFO because someone saw something in the sky, but when the two pilots chased that UFO, they didn't see anything themselves in the sky, and only one of the FCS, F-16, sorry, I'm talking French, F-16, so those are the jet plane. Only one of those jet planes, the pilots didn't see anything, so there was no visual confirmation from the pilots, and only one of them had a strange reading on his radar. So the conclusion of the army was there was a malfunction of the radar. Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. But there was an inversion of temperature of the on the ground that created an artifact on the radar. So even the radar detection for the Belgian UFO waves are not so impressive. So all that being said, I think the wave can be explained by that sentence from Klaas. That's his rule for UFO waves. Once news coverage leads the public to believe that UFOs may be in the vicinity, there are numerous natural and man-made objects, which, especially when seen at night, can take on unusual characteristics in the minds of hopeful viewers. The UFO reports, in turn, add to the mass excitement, which encourages still more observers to watch for UFOs. This situation feeds upon itself until such time as the media lose interest in the subject, and then the flap quickly runs out of steam. Here you go. That was my presentation. Thank you for listening to me.